Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Paul Blumenthal, a reporter for the Huffington Post who covers money and politics. We'll examine investigations now underway into some of the biggest billionaire super PAC donors in this election cycle who have allegedly violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Then we'll look into why the latest round of talks in Moscow between the G5 plus one and Iran appear to have failed. Investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus, the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, joins us to discuss the deep well of bitterness between the U.S. and Iran, which may explain why the Iranian delegation used up much of the negotiation laying out a long list of grievances with the West. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of why Pakistan's Supreme Court dismissed Prime Minister Gilani from office, throwing an already unpopular government further into crisis. Junaid Ahmad, a professor of law at Lahore University in Pakistan, joins us to discuss this latest episode of a political soap opera that is distracting Pakistanis from serious and growing domestic and foreign policy concerns. Joining us now is Paul Blumenthal, a reporter who covers money and politics for the Huffington Post and previously was the senior writer at the Sunshine Foundation, a nonpartisan organization which uses cutting-edge technology and ideas to make government transparent and accountable. He focuses attention on the intersection between the influence of campaign funding and political decisions made in Washington and has an article at the Huffington Post, Super PAC Donors Face Federal Investigations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Blumenthal.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And tell me about some of the biggest super PAC donors who now are apparently being investigated for violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Well, there are a number of donors who are under investigation for these kind of potential violations. Probably the most prominent one that people know about is the investigation into Walmart after the New York Times reported on potential payments that company officials made and then covered up in Mexico. And two of the children of the founder of Walmart, Jim and Alice Walton, have each given $200,000 to a super PAC called Restore Our Future that supports Mitt Romney's presidential bid. There's also Sheldon Adelson, who's a casino magnate who has properties from Las Vegas all the way to Macau in China. And he's under three separate investigations into his operations in China, allegations that state that officials at his company had made payments to not only Chinese officials, but also members of the Chinese mafia known as the Triads. There's also the Koch brothers, whose company, Koch Industries, is under investigation, and they have stated that they plan on spending upwards of $100 million to defeat President Obama in this election. There's also Meg Whitman, who ran for governor of California and is now the CEO of Hewlett-Packard, and Hewlett-Packard is also under investigation under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. So you have a lot of these wealthy people who have a lot of interest before the government, and they're spending more than they've ever been able to spend before in these elections.
But this is not the connection between the super PACs and their foreign corrupt practices. There's no real connection there. It's a coincidence that they're giving money to super PACs at the same time they're being investigated. Or does this raise questions about international money laundering?
Well, the fear that people have is that, you know, this money could potentially buy influence in a future administration, and that influence could come in a variety of ways, whether it's, you know, some kind of direct action to stop an investigation, which would be probably the most outrageous kind of influence you could have, to sort of an appointing of people to the Department of Justice, to the Securities Exchange Commission, to be able to have these people who aren't really of the mind to go about investigating certain companies or any companies at all for these kind of violations, or simply just a shifting away of the priority that's been established in the past two administrations to go after companies for Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violations and try to clean up corporate business overseas. And this could happen if, you know, there's tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars coming from these donors. The politicians know who is helping them get elected, even if sometimes the public doesn't know, and that can often translate into influence.
Well, there's no question that this administration's, that the previous administration, George W. Bush administration, did not prosecute anybody under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
Well, the actual uptick in investigations began towards the end of the Bush administration in 2007. And I guess the irony of that is that that began under the Attorney General Michael Mukasey, who now works for the Chamber of Commerce, and he is their lead lobbyist trying to loosen the law so that corporations face fewer enforcement actions from the Department of Justice. So some of these actions did actually begin under Bush, but sort of late in the administration. Most of the uptick comes from the fact that a lot of other countries have adopted similar laws, and the U.S. adopted this law in the 1970s. Only recently did Britain adopt a similar, actually tougher law, and then you have countries like China, India, Russia that have also adopted similar laws, so it makes it easier to have these, like, cross-border enforcement actions actually take place and sharing of information between the governments.
Again, I'm speaking with Paul Blumenthal, a reporter who covers money and politics for The Huffington Post and previously was a senior writer at the Sunlight Foundation, a nonpartisan organization which uses cutting-edge technology and ideas to make government transparent and accountable. He focuses his attention on the intersection between the influence of campaign funding and political decisions made in Washington and has an article at The Huffington Post, Super PAC Donors Face Federal Investigations. Now, Sheldon Adelson, I think he's the seventh richest man in America, worth some $26 billion. Of course, having spent $10 million, I think $20 million on Gingrich and put up $10 million for Romney, and he said that's only the beginning. He could put up $100 million. One of the things about that that I find extraordinary is that it seems to be fairly obvious that, you know, there's a connection here to Netanyahu, because Adelson's he's devoted his fortune and his life, if you will, to Netanyahu. He has bought a TV network in Israel devoted to promoting Netanyahu. He publishes a free newspaper that's given away free that promotes Netanyahu. And turns out that Netanyahu and Romney are very, very old and close friends, going back to when they were both starting out, graduating from MIT and Harvard Business Schools, respectively. They have quite a deep bond, and it seems to me not exactly conspiratorial to assume that Adelson actually kept Gingrich in the race in order to split the anti-Romney vote. And I guess if my theory is correct, that raises the question of foreign influence already in an American election.
Well, I mean, we've also seen Senator John McCain, who said that, you know, you have Sheldon Adelson is making most of his money now from China, so you have this sort of, his profits come from another country, they come from the interests of other countries. That's why paying attention to these foreign corrupt practices investigations is important for somebody whose most of his business nowadays is being done overseas. And clearly his biggest interest is supporting a particular political party in a foreign country, that being the Likud government of Benjamin Netanyahu over in Israel. And I think that certainly raises questions about what kind of interests this, $100 million or more is going to buy in Congress or in the White House.
Well, there's a whistleblower involved in the Macau story, isn't there, Paul Blumenthal? Somebody that was involved in setting up these deals in Macau, a former Portuguese colony that China has now taken over and was always a kind of offshore Las Vegas like Cuba was before Castro. Pretty seedy place. And he alleges that Adelson paid off the criminal gang, the Triads, in order to get these casino concessions that, in many ways, aren't they the source of why his wealth has doubled? I mean, it's ironic to me that this guy has, you know, doubled his multi-billion fortune in the very period when Obama's been president and he's dedicated to getting rid of Obama.
Well, yeah, I mean, that seems to be the case with lots of conservative billionaires at the moment who, you know, they got a big tax cut under George Bush. They got estate tax cuts for their children, and now it appears that they're spending that money on the political process to get more tax cuts.
But what about the Macau case? Adelson says this guy's just a disgruntled employee, but how serious are his, I mean, his allegations are serious, but what's your sense of where that investigation is going to go?
I mean, there are three investigations, one in DOJ and a few in the SEC that are going on. Those are the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act investigations. And then there are multiple lawsuits in courts in Las Vegas where journalists have been following this a lot closer than I have, about I believe the guy's name is Steve Jacobs, who's making the accusations against Las Vegas Sands, which is Sheldon Adelson's company, that he helped facilitate these payments to government officials in Macau and to the triads also. It's the casino business, which has never had a great track record of being clean when it comes to money. So you have to give some validity to these kind of allegations in an industry that's known for corruption and bribery for most of its existence.
And Paul Blumenthal, just turning to the Charles and David Koch, because they're already fairly prominent. They're somewhat the poster boys for all that progressives see wrong about the American political system in the extent to which they are so aggressive in promoting their political candidates and their political issues, most of which end up serving the interests of Koch Industries in a fairly fundamental way. They've also funded this this group, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. How vulnerable do you think they are in terms of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act?
Well, I mean, all of these investigations, the thing to understand is most of them wind up with the companies paying maybe a hefty sum, but nobody ever winds up going to jail, which, tends to be the case for most of these investigations. Koch Industries, they might not terribly care about paying some kind of fine. I mean, they've paid so many fines in the past for environmental law breaking and various other offenses that I'm sure a lot of progressives could name better than I could. The case for a lot of these companies and the problem, particularly for companies like Walmart or Hewlett-Packard or even a casino business that's trying to do business overseas like Sheldon Adelson's, is that, they're consumer-facing, front-facing companies that also do business with the government. And, you don't want this sort of black eye, this black mark of you've been paying foreign governments to be able to get business. It also just doesn't look good overseas in that you're contributing to corruption that is actually hurting millions of people by keeping them, under the thumb of corrupt governments that are forcing companies to make these payments.
But Paul Blumenthal, since you've been covering money and politics for some time, these super PACs, like the ones that are under investigation, that the Walmart people gave money to Restore Our Future, which is Mitt Romney's super PAC and others, the other favorite cutout or repository for money appears to be these 501c4 super PACs. I guess they are super PACs, but they're originally set up under an IRS provision meant for charity. And their advantage to the donors is that you don't have to disclose who you are. And that is one of the reasons why a lot of money is going in them. And I think Adelson is going to put a lot of money into them because he's fairly secretive, even though everybody's been talking about how much money he's been giving so far. What is to stop foreign governments, just to reverse it a little bit from the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, where U.S. business people can be charged for bribing foreign officials? What about foreign officials bribing our politicians via these 501c4 shelters?
The thing with the 501c4, they're called social welfare nonprofits, is what they're officially referred to as, and they're governed by the Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, which governs all taxes and tax policy. And they have to disclose their donors to the IRS, but not to the public. So, I mean, the IRS would review and see if they are getting money from a foreign government, from a foreign official, and using that money on elections. I mean, there is some kind of oversight for that. However, the big issue for them is that they, in many cases, are simply acting as political committees. They're running these ads that they claim are about issues, but really target specific candidates in swing races or in swing states when they're targeting President Obama or Mitt Romney. And, what they The problem is that the public has no clue as to how this money is being spent, when in fact things like Citizens United and many other court decisions have stated that transparency is absolutely necessary if we're going to have any kind of political spending, let alone unlimited political spending. So, you know, the public winds up at a loss here, even though there is some amount of oversight that, you know, the IRS would provide.
Well, as you probably recall, Paul Blumenthal, the president at the State of the Union a couple of years back, just after Citizens United, when he was castigating the ruling, he mentioned that this could open up the possibility of foreign money pouring into our elections, and that prompted Justice Alito to say not true, or mouth not true. And that was quite a kind of flap in itself. But right after Citizens United was announced by the Supreme Court, the Democrats tried to pass the Disclose Act to enforce the very transparency that we're talking about. So just in closing, how open is this system to the very thing that the president said in the State of the Union is quite possible that foreign money could influence our elections, which prompted Alito's response?
I think that there's, you know, probably a very, very small chance that foreign money will make its way into our elections. It seems mostly unlikely considering the kind of laws that are in place, the fact that the IRS has oversight over a lot of these kind of contributions, and the fact that subsequent court decisions have pretty much said that, you know, foreign citizens aren't allowed to contribute and upheld that ban. I think, you know, maybe a bigger concern is how we actually look at what is foreign money when you have multinational corporations that really operate within no borders of a government, and they're the ones who can spend freely no matter where they are actually based or where they're paying taxes. And maybe that's a bigger scandal than actually a foreign government or a foreign corporation spending money in our elections, the fact that we have these corporations that have no home that are allowed to freely spend to influence our elections.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Paul Blumenthal.
Well, thanks for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter who covers money and politics for the Huffington Post and previously was a senior writer at the Sunlight Foundation, a nonpartisan organization which uses cutting-edge technology and ideas to make government transparent and accountable. He focuses his attention on the intersection between the influence of campaign funding and political decisions made in Washington, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Super PAC Donors Face Federal Investigations. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the P5+1 talks with Iran in Moscow that seemed to have gone nowhere.
But the music that excels is the sound of oil wells as they slurp, slurp, slurp into the barrels. My little home will be quaint as an old parasol, and instead of carpets I'll have money wall to wall. I want an old-fashioned house with an old-fashioned fence and an old-fashioned millionaire.
You say yes, I say no. You say stop, but I say go.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfuss, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Tom Paine, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He is the author of Devil's Game: How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfuss.
Thanks. Always great to be here.
And the talks between the G5+1 in Moscow with Iran appear to have been, shall we say, less than fruitful. It seems that the Iranian delegation took up much of Monday with a list of grievances going back many decades against the West, and they've sort of agreed to have lower level talks, you know, without admitting that this round of talks have been a complete failure, which they appear to have been. It seems to me that this may indicate this deep well of bitterness that exists between Iran and the United States. Would that explain why the Iranians used up so much of the time, instead of negotiating, listing their grievances?
Well, you know, both sides have a long list of grievances, and I don't think that means, however, that the current round of talks was a complete failure. I think it's very important that over the last 3 months, there's now been a series of three world meetings between big powers and Iran, and that the talks are going to continue going forward. It's not something that anyone should think could be resolved quickly. And I'm really, in fact, encouraged by the fact that the administration in the United States is still talking, as well as the fact that the Iranians are still talking, because I think they know deep underneath what the shape of an agreement might look like. But getting from here to there is going to require concessions on both sides, not just on one side. And I'm not sure that either the United States or Iran want to make those concessions before the elections. Both countries have elections in November for president of the United States and in June for president of Iran. So my guess is that the talks will probably continue through next summer until they get serious. And that's all to the good, because among other things, as long as the talks are going on, you're not going to hear very loud war cries from anybody, because they know that they can't really attack Iran as long as the negotiations are underway.
Well, but every time I speak to Iranians, whether they are on the left or members of the Communist Two-Day Party that was essentially eradicated by the Islamists, or the Islamists, those sympathetic to the Islamic Republic of Iran's government, invariably Mossadegh is brought up and the coup against him and how the West has imposed the Shah on them and all that bitterness. And then on the American side, of course, the fact that the hostages were taken in the U.S. embassy, and that ever since then there's been this endless litany of the great Satan, etc., and death to America, death to America. I don't think it plays very well with the average American. How much is that a problem here? You don't see these atmospherics of being really an important ingredient here?
Well, I think they're important in that they've created animosity over many decades. But I don't think that's what the negotiations are about. I mean, we negotiated agreements with the USSR on arms limitation, with all kinds of political and other grievances going back many years. And so I just think we don't expect these talks to lead to an American-Iran alliance or some sort of happy reconciliation. They're simply about an agreement to solve one particular problem. It's not going to solve the issue of Iran's relationship with Iraq or the Arabs. It's not going to solve Iran's relationship to Hamas and Hezbollah. It's not going to solve the responsibility of the United States for overthrowing Mossadegh, which after all was more than 60 years ago. And these things just are too difficult to put into one negotiation. So I don't see why an agreement can't be reached, but the political obstacle is that if Obama were to get up tomorrow and say, yes, Iran has the right to enrich uranium, he would be attacked by the Republicans and it would become a political issue in the election. There's no solution without him saying that. That's part of the deal that has to be reached. By the same token, if the Iranians were to say, we're going to open up our country to complete intrusive inspections by the IAEA and other agencies, and we agree to limit our enrichment of uranium to 3-5% for fuel only, then that's going to open up a whole political crisis inside Iran among people, especially their hawks, who think that any kind of agreement that limits Iran's freedoms is the work of the devil. So these things are difficult to solve. I think they can be solved. obstacles between now and next summer are enormous.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, an investigative journalist who's written extensively on Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Tom Paine, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Now, Robert, the lead Iranian negotiator, Saeed Jalili, he reiterated Iran's basic position that the enrichment of uranium is non-negotiable. You're suggesting that if the President Obama agreed with that, Mitt Romney would be all over him in a second, which he already is at any rate, suggesting that Obama gives too much away. And that's probably why Obama can't apologize to the Pakistanis to open up the supplies into Afghanistan. But nevertheless, there was a sort of very self-righteous tone in what Jalili was saying. There is no reason or excuse to have doubt regarding the peaceful aims of Iran's nuclear program. Now, they keep saying that, but the obvious fact is that nobody in the West, and particularly in the United States, believes that, right? The bottom line here seems to be that the assumption on the part of the Americans, and even more so on the part of the Israelis, is that Iran simply cannot have a nuclear weapon.
Well, I think there are two different issues here that are entangled. One is the right to enrich uranium domestically for civilian purposes. The other is the right to enrich uranium to bomb grade, which is highly enriched uranium, and then give Iran the potential to turn that uranium into a nuclear weapon. Now, it should be said that Iran is a long way from being able to manufacture atomic weapons. They just don't have the material. We aren't even sure that they have the technology. They don't have the missiles to deliver one. This is a very difficult process and could take them years to master. So it isn't like this is an urgent threat that needs to be dealt with immediately. So that's the first point to make. The second is that I'm as skeptical as the next person about why Iran is developing this fuel cycle and enriching uranium. Maybe, in fact, they do want to manufacture a bomb further down the road. Maybe they just want to get close to that ability, the so-called turn of the screw close, where they can then become a nuclear power quickly but not quite cross the threshold. Maybe they are sincere, although I find it hard to believe that they intend only to enrich uranium for fuel. But whatever the truth of it is, this is a struggle for power in which Iran is going to have to make concessions if it wants to end the economic sanctions and the political isolation that it's facing. And the United States is going to have to make concessions if it wants to get something serious from Iran. So when Jalili, as you say, notes that Iran is not going to give up its right to enrich uranium, I think that that is the bottom line for the Iranians. And the United States has edged toward accepting that over the past 2 years. And there have been many people engaged in back-channel talks with Iran who've explored that notion as well and come away convinced that there's a deal to be made there. Senator John Kerry said that a couple of years ago, that Iran does in fact have the right to enrich uranium. And the Obama administration is getting close to saying that, but that's their trump card. They can't play it without some reciprocal concession from Iran, and that's the difficulty in this negotiation. So the Iranians say, we want sanctions to be lifted before we do anything else. Under the current circumstances, that's a non-starter. So maybe there's some plan where sanctions could be gradually ease in exchange for step-by-step compliance by Iran. But all this, you know, this is difficult stuff for diplomats. They need to work out all kinds of intricate agreements while realizing that the other side could walk away at any moment. That's why I think it's going to take a while, and we should just all take a deep breath and let the negotiations proceed and realize that the people who are calling for bombing Iran are extremists. It's not a necessary step because Iran isn't that close to having a bomb, and it wouldn't be, as so many people have said, wouldn't be effective anyway. So,
but when you say, Robert,
administration, yeah, go ahead.
But when you say, Robert Dreyfuss, that it's that this we have to allow this laborious and painstaking diplomatic process to proceed. On the other hand, it's pretty simple, isn't it? If you say Kerry has indicated, the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that Iran has the right to enrich. Of course, Iran has the right to enrich, and everybody has said that, but within internationally recognized safeguards. And a lot of the suspicion is that these underground facilities have been discovered not by IAEA inspectors, but by intelligence agencies, and that there's been a history of secrecy here. So it's really a very simple thing. If the Iranians really want to give up, want to enrich uranium, and they are able to do it under internationally agreed safeguards. So that's where the rub is, and they're somehow, for some reason or other, prepared to pay an enormous price on their economy and on their people in order to have this right to enrich.
That's true, but the United Nations Security Council resolutions that have passed over the past 5 years call on Iran to suspend all enrichment. So the official position of the P5 plus one is not that Iran has the right to enrich uranium. Their official position is that Iran has to suspend enrichment and open itself to inspectors to make sure that everything is on the up and up. And in exchange for that, they have not pledged to lift sanctions besides. So the Iranians are faced with a unilateral demand from the West that they suspend their enrichment, that they open up for inspections with no guarantees that they get any relief from economic sanctions.
No, but now, this is not, but Robert, that's not the West. It's the P5 plus one, which are the five permanent members of the Security Council: Russia, China, United States, Britain, France, plus Germany. I mean, that's what I've.
That's what I said. These are United Nations Security Council resolutions.
Right. So that's not the West.
Russia. So, well, okay, but we know who's driving this. It isn't.
Right.
Russia,
but the fact that that the Russians and the Chinese, who are very sympathetic to Iran, have joined in it, surely that says something, doesn't it?
Well, it says that partly they're trying to, you know, keep the peace between the West and Iran, and they're also, you know, not in favor of Iran developing a nuclear weapon. But they've opposed any draconian sanctions against Iran. So most of the economic sanctions that have been imposed on Iran are unilateral or multilateral ones outside of the UN resolutions. In other words, they're by the United States, they're by Western Europe, and those are the things which are hurting Iran now, not the economic sanctions that come out of UN resolutions. But in the meantime, the UN resolutions, which Russia and China support, do say that Iran has to suspend its nuclear program. And in order to back down from that, that's an important step. That's a big deal. It's not just as easy as you say to say, oh, well, Iran has the right to enrich uranium, because that's their trump card. That's what they have to play in order to get real concessions from Iran. And so far, the Iranians aren't willing to make the first move, and neither is the P5 plus one. So, you know, are they saying this to each other behind the scenes? We don't know, because nobody, you know, is on the inside of these meetings. The Iranians' last meeting was in Moscow, and they had frank talks just one-on-one between the Russian delegation and the Iranian one. And as you know, Obama just met President Putin this week, and I'm sure is working very closely with Russia, trying to get Russia to, you know, put pressure on Iran. But Russia has its own real interests at stake, and so does Iran, and so does China, and not everybody wants to do America's bidding, so this is very complex. And that's why I'm saying 3 years ago, everyone was talking about, is Israel going to bomb Iran? Now, thanks to this diplomacy, the Obama administration has changed the topic, and we've stopped talking about an imminent military attack, and we're talking about talks, which is good. That's progress. And if it takes another 2 years to reach an agreement, I'm okay with that. There's no big hurry.
Well, as you know, Robert Dreyfus, Flint Leverett, who was formerly in charge of the Iran desk at the National Security Council under President George W. Bush, he's recently wrote an article suggesting that the Obama administration, of course, the assumption is that they want to negotiate till after the elections, and maybe they made a deal with Israel to give them a green light. But Flint Leverett says no. He's convinced that the Obama administration actually wants to go to war against Iran.
Yeah, well, I don't agree with that at all. I don't think that the Obama administration has the slightest intention of going to war with Iran. It is not comparable to George Bush and Iraq, because the Bush administration did want to go to a war with Iraq. It did fabricate reasons to do so, and then it went to war. I think the last thing that the Obama administration wants is war with Iran. In fact, they're much more concerned, as you know, about what they call the pivot to Asia, about issues relating to China, and about the global economic crisis, which would be dramatically worse if there was war with Iran, because that would completely destroy the oil market. It would send all kinds of countries beyond Greece and Spain into a downward spiral toward disaster. It would probably collapse the world's financial markets. So we're talking about, you know, a catastrophic event in terms of what it would mean to attack Iran. And I just don't see any, I mean, there's no evidence that Obama wants to go to war. Even Dennis Ross, who was one of the most hawkish members of the Obama administration until recently, who just left his post, has just come out saying that the United States ought to recognize Iran's right to enrich uranium. That's a big deal. People are moving in that direction. And, you know, I know Flint Leverett. I have a lot of respect for his work, but I just don't see any evidence. And by the way, not just me, but I think most experts would agree that there's no evidence that the Obama administration wants a war, quite the opposite.
Well, just in closing, Robert Dreyfus, Catherine Ashton, the European Union's foreign policy chief and the lead negotiator for the G5+1, she said that that there is a possibility that the six powers might be willing to relax one of the sanctions that's been threatening Iran, and that is a provision that bans insurers based in Europe from covering ships that carry Iranian oil anywhere in the world. That's obviously the sanctions are beginning to bite. What do you make of that?
Well, that would be, I think, a constructive way of showing that there's some good faith maybe somewhere mixed up in all of this. Of course, part of the reason that they're talking about that is that there are a lot of people in the West, in London, where the world oil insurance market is based, among world oil companies, among the Japanese and Koreans and Indians and Chinese who get oil from Iran, all of whom would be very upset if some measure like the one you just described were implemented that shuts down Iran's oil exports to those countries in Asia. So, there's a lot of people, I think, around the world who would like to see that sanction avoided. Whether it happens or not, I don't know. But I think that's, you know, if it does happen, I think that would be the start of perhaps, you know, the beginning of a step-by-step process that would move things forward in the talks.
So at this point, the sanctions are beginning to bite, and you think that there's a possibility of a give and take on both sides?
Yeah, well, it's more than beginning to bite. I mean, I think that the economic sanctions of the past 12 months or so have been quite severe in terms of affecting Iran's economy. The fact is, however, that as true as that is, until we see signs of mass labor strikes or unrest or other political problems. It has no relationship to the decision-making process in Iran because its leaders aren't effective. And so even if the economy is in bad shape, the only way that could affect their decision-making about the nuclear program is if they felt that their political regime was threatened. And just so far, there's no evidence of that. So I don't think the sanctions are productive politically. In fact, they may be counterproductive because they're getting a lot of Iranians mad at the United States and the West and not mad at their leadership. It was only 3 years ago that Iranians were gathering in the streets in millions to protest what they felt was a rigged election. And now a lot of those people who were probably out in the streets may be rallying to the government's side because they feel like Iran is under attack.
Well, Robert Dreyfus, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iran, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, Tom Paine, and other, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment talking about the sacking of Pakistan's prime minister.
I'm sorry, so sorry, that I was such a fool. I didn't know love could be so cruel.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Junaid Ahmad, who's a professor of law at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan. His research interests include constitutional theory, political Islam, globalization, and Islamic social movements. He's here in the United States for a U.S.-Pakistan Leaders Forum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Junaid Ahmad.
Great to be with you.
And, of course, there's been a political bombshell let off in Pakistan, yes, where the Supreme Court has ruled to disqualify Prime Minister Gilani and vacate him from office. This is, of course, already throwing a fairly unpopular Pakistani government into further disarray. What's your sense of, here you are at a U.S.-Pakistan Leadership Forum. I guess this is the last thing you want to hear, right?
Right. Well, you know, I hope there's no conspiracy theories as to what we were concocting here in Washington, D.C. But it wasn't expected because folks who've been following Pakistan will know that after about 6 months or so, elections are planned to be held in Pakistan. And this was perhaps going to be and so might be the first civilian government to fulfill its 5-year term in office. And that would be a first in Pakistan's history, where there normally is a military coup that typically shortens the length of these civilian governments. So, but at the same time, the Supreme Court has been after the prime minister, specifically on the issue of reopening the corruption cases against the sitting president of the country, another PPP stalwart and the chairman of the Pakistan People's Party, Asif Ali Zardari, which up until now the prime minister has refused to do. So that was the background. We knew that the Supreme Court was after the prime minister. It was just a question of whether they would actually, you know, ask the prime minister to step down from office.
So the roots of this come in a ruling a contempt ruling by the Supreme Court because Gilani refused to ask Swiss authorities to reopen corruption cases against President Zardari, allegations that go back to the 1990s when he and his wife, of course, the late President Benazir Bhutto, were suspected of using Swiss bank accounts to launder up to $12 million in bribes, apparently, allegedly from companies seeking customs inspection contracts. I mean, Zardari's often been referred to as Mr. 10%. He's not exactly held in high regard by the average Pakistani, is he?
Right. In fact, that's an old title of his. Unfortunately, Mr. 10% is often now called Mr. 20 or 30%. Once he assumed the office of the presidency, the Mr. 10% was perhaps the title when he was investment minister and when Benazir was in power in the 90s. But I think that the other, the background to all of this is the National Reconciliation Ordinance that was promulgated toward the end of the military dictator Musharraf's rule, which essentially gave amnesty to all these politicians, but was specifically meant for the Pakistan People's Party politicians like Benazir and others, so to allow them to facilitate their return to power. And the Supreme Court had declared this ordinance as unconstitutional and therefore had pressed upon the Pakistan People's Party government to move ahead with these charges against not just Zardari, but including the President Zardari. And, of course, the Prime Minister Gilani had owed his own position to Zardari. So he had refused to carry forward these the pressure on the Swiss authorities to reopen these corruption cases. And he was held in contempt of court. And from that time, he still refused to move on this question. So, like I said, it was Pakistan was rife with speculation of whether the Supreme Court would go ahead and ask him to just step down from office because even after the contempt of court justice, he really has not moved on this. So it was a question of when they would actually do it, but even of if they would actually do it, since there's so few months left before the next elections anyways.
Again, I'm speaking with Junaid Ahmad, who's a professor of law at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan, and we're talking about the sacking by the Supreme Court of the Prime Minister Gilani and the subsequent political turmoil as an election approaches. This does feel like about the last thing that Pakistan needs. I mean, there's some serious problems that should be getting the attention of Pakistan's leader, and the president had to come back from Moscow to deal with this current crisis. I mean, you've got the threat from the Islamists. There was a popular singer that was shot recently, I take it, by Islamists. And you've got now we hear that the Taliban are banning immunizations in the Northwest Territories, immunizations for polio. There's some serious stuff going on. This feels a little bit like kind of reality TV in a way, a bit of a soap opera, isn't it?
Pakistan seems to be the land of diversionary issues. Issues which perhaps do not have great significance or importance for, in terms of affecting the ordinary Pakistani, but become huge or generate huge media frenzies around them. And I think you're absolutely right on this matter as well. Although, this has been an old tussle that analysts in Pakistan have been observing between the army establishment, which many say have been backing the judiciary in moving forward in these cases against the Pakistan People's Party government-led government. And so that tussle has been ongoing. And you're absolutely right, the issues confronting Pakistan right now, although I must say the singer who is originally from the northwestern areas of Pakistan, it's now been learned, was killed merely by an ex-husband of hers. It was not the Taliban. But nevertheless, there's, of course, the issue of the militancy and the insurgency in the Northwest. There's the serious deterioration in U.S.-Pakistan relations over the past, now year and a half, but particularly over the past several months, the inability to resolve the issue of the resumption of the NATO supply lines that go from Pakistan and supply the equipment to the NATO forces in Afghanistan. And internally, of course, issues of power and electricity is just really devastating, not just industry, but of course, ordinary people throughout the country, and of course, growing inequality and poverty and so on. So just incredible amount of issues internally in Pakistan, as well as between the United States and Pakistan. And, you know, your listeners will know that sort of the war on terror as it's being waged in the region has deeply affected Pakistan and the rise of militancy in Pakistan as a result of that. So all of these issues are there on the one hand, and then we have this political crisis in which the prime minister has been unseated and we have elections coming up. So it's Pakistan just seems to go from one crisis to the next.
And of course, Junaid Ahmad, just to sort of add more to the mix here, a Pakistani real estate tycoon has accused the Supreme Court justice who issued this ruling vacating the office of the Prime Minister of turning a blind eye to his own son's alleged corrupt financial practices. So,
another major issue that has emerged. And again, I think following up on the theme of diversionary issues. I mean, you know, there are some analysts which are speculating, again, to divert the attention from the Supreme Court Chief Justice's own, interference and in these cases involving this big real estate tycoon, Malik Riaz, and his, in fact, indifference to what his son was up to. To then go and press forward with this removal of the prime minister is very much related to that.
And when you refer to the Pakistani people have much more on their plate than these diversionary things, I mean, these power cuts that we're talking about largely in Punjab are up to 18 hours a day in the heat of the summer. That's clearly a sign. So let me ask you about the broader issues here. I mean, I think one of the reasons why Obama can't apologize for the killing of the 24 Pakistani soldiers on that border post is because Mitt Romney's already accused Obama of having a foreign policy of apologizing. And that may be part of the deadlock in terms of opening the supply lines. At least that's what the Pakistani government has said, that that's their bottom line. The U.S. appears to be making deals with the Russians and the Stans for an alternative way out. Is there any likelihood that the Pakistanis and the Americans will stop talking past each other and start dealing honestly with each other? Because this relationship is very poisonous, clearly.
Yeah. And it becomes even difficult to do so in an election year, as you're pointing out, sort of the accusations from Romney and the Republicans. But, I that's not to say that I think there was a real opportunity right after the actual incident itself in November last year. And in fact, now we know through WikiLeaks and it was leaked to the Pakistani press as well, that in fact the U.S. ambassador in Pakistan was in favor of a very quick apology, which may have, avoided all of these the issues that emerged later on. But right now, you're absolutely right. The Pakistanis have pretty much continued to insist on an apology for what happened. And in addition to that, the significant issue of the drone campaign that the U.S. continues to wage in Pakistan, the Pakistani government, I mean, not just the military establishment, which, of course, is becoming quite, in Pakistan, is becoming quite, nationalist, but also parliament. The Pakistani parliament has demanded that the U.S. review and hopefully end its drone campaign in Pakistan as well. Now, of course, the Obama administration this year, during an election year, has rejected both of these, really, these demands. And that's not to say that, even within the Obama administration itself, there have been differences on this question. There have been tensions. And I think for many Pakistanis, it's been unfortunate, I'm sure for many Americans, that it seems that every single time on these matters, the CIA and the Pentagon tend to get their view, over the view of, say, the State Department. That's what it seems like to many Pakistani analysts, that are trying to understand, you know, something like this question of apology.
Well, just in closing, Junaid Hamad, since you're here at the U.S.-Pakistan Leadership Conference, there are hints that the U.S. may be, a lot of the officials, and particularly the Secretary of Defense, seem to be pretty fed up. And as the U.S. withdraws from Afghanistan, and if indeed they withdraw via the stands and get all that equipment out, there's a sense that the U.S. might be washing its hands of Pakistan. Now, was there any of that coming up in the meeting that you just had? Is there a sense that this relationship is not just a question of a kind of, you know, use the analogy of a married couple? It's not that they're having a trial separation. They may actually get a divorce.
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the way many of us speak about the U.S.-Pakistan relationship is that it's a bad marriage with no hope for divorce. and that seems to be the situation. I mean, I think that Pakistan is just such an important country, close to 200 million nuclear armed in that part of the world, geostrategically incredibly important, and with a very powerful military. And so I think that type of an approach, I just really don't think it's feasible. I think that right now from both sides, both the Americans and the Pakistanis, and I dare say that more so from Washington, I really think there needs to be a realization that Pakistan is also a player, has its own interests in Afghanistan and the region, and concerns, whether it's of greater Indian influence in Afghanistan or other players in the region like Russia. And the Pakistanis will always have a concern of what's going on next door in Afghanistan, in Kabul, who the regime is in Kabul. So I think that once that type of realization comes about from the United States, from policymakers in Washington, can we see Washington and Islamabad coming back to the table and really joining together to bring about a regional solution to the heart of the issue, and that is the crisis in Afghanistan. I think that right now often all of the blame is just deflected onto to Pakistan, when I think that Afghanistan itself is still in a mess. It still has outside powers meddling in its affairs, supporting their horses in the race, and Pakistan does the same. It says that it deserves to also have a horse in the race. And I think that once those regional interests are understood and appreciated, and I think once all these players are brought to the table, can a solution come about. Otherwise, I really don't see much hope for U.S.-Pakistan relations.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Junaid Hamad.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Junaid Hamad, who's a professor of law at Lahore University of Management Sciences in Pakistan. His research interests include constitutional theory, political Islam, globalization, and Islamic social movements. He's here in the United States for a U.S.-Pakistan leadership forum. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.